welcome to Section 9. My name's Damien Hull.
And I'm Dorothy.
And today we're going to be talking about DNS and Bind. And this is part of our Raspberry Pi project where we're going to be putting together a data center using Raspberry Pis. And we're learning how these different services work. So there's a couple things that we have learned along the way and some things I want us to think about. And we did something a couple days ago where we looked at all of the Bind servers that we have, your virtual machine, our Gigabyte server, which is local on our network, and then one of our cloud servers. And that leads us into management, IT management. And so as I was thinking about this, I thought, you know what, this is perfect for something we do in security and something that I think a lot of organizations struggle with, which are policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines. And we're going to get to that in a minute. But where I want to start is with just simple, plain DNS. And how does that work?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to keep in mind is you have me do the research about, okay, what is this service? How do we install it? How do we configure it? And then what do we need to do to manage it? So that's going to be kind of our MO, that we're just going to have to do that across the board with every service that we do. And so in order to do that, we need to really understand how DNS works. Because in our project right now, we're trying to implement it on the Raspberry Pi, but then we go ahead and we test it on my virtual machine. So having said that, do we understand really how DNS works?
And I'm going to say no to that.
And I mean, most people know, oh, you give it a name, and it'll give you an IP address, or it will look for that IP address, you know, when you put in your name, or you put in the IP address and it will pop up whatever website it is. But that is like what most people know about DNS. But it's a little more complicated than that, as we figured out the second time around that we went to do this. So do you want to kind of get into it, or what do you want to do with this?
So let's go with an example here. Now, we have internal DNS and we have external DNS. Those are two things that we can talk about. So let's start with section9.us. So you're on your workstation, you turn it on, it's going to get a DHCP assigned address.
Right.
So it's going to get an IP address, a subnet mask, a default gateway, and a DNS server. And in our case, it's going to get our Gigabyte server's IP address, because that's where we have Bind configured, and that's our DNS for our local network. Now, when you open up your browser and you type in section9.us, what happens?
Well, it's going to try to look. It's going to go to the local DNS server, and it's going to try to find out if it knows the IP address. It'll say, hey, do you know the IP address of section9.us, right? And then if our local server knows this, it's going to cache that information if it hasn't done this before. And then when the workstation gets the information back, it's also going to cache it in there.
Correct. But now let's say that our local Bind DNS server doesn't know the IP address of section9.us. What happens in that case?
Okay. This is where it's fuzzy for me. I know that out in the internet somewhere, there is this DNS hierarchy kind of map that goes DNS, and then it goes .com, .net, .us, .whatever. It, you know, and then it has some kind of, you know, I know it's supposed to go out there and find the DNS server that it knows that information. But again, when you take me out of a local server, I'm fuzzy about things. So can you explain it to me again, please?
So this is how it works. And here's my little backstory to this. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I wanted to set up my own email server, and I needed to have a domain name for that. And these were things I was learning about, right? I just wanted to have my own email server, get my own email, and say, hey, look, I manage my own email server. So I had to buy a domain name, which in our case right now, it's section9.us. And then, of course, I had to have an email server, so I figured out how to do that. But then I had to set up DNS for this to work. So that's when I learned about DNS servers. And then eventually I got into managing my own DNS servers, which is Bind. And that's when I learned about the 13 root servers.
Okay, that's what I was trying to remember.
Right. So DNS is sort of like an upside down tree structure. And it was confusing to me when I started. And it's still a little fuzzy. because a lot of the stuff happens behind the scenes and we don't really think about it. It's not like, oh, I'm thinking about the 13 root servers every time I use DNS. It's just there, it works, and I just use it. So what happens when you type in section9.us on your browser, on your workstation? It goes to our Gigabyte server. Bind responds to that information and says, okay, you're looking for section9.us and you want the IP address for that. Well, I don't have that. I don't know where that's located. So I'm going to go to one of the 13 root servers, and those servers are going to say, okay, you're looking for .us. That's the top level domain that you're looking for. And they call that the TLD for short. So the server is going to respond and say, okay, you need to go to this other server that takes care of .us domains. So our local bind server is going to go to the TLD server that handles .us. The .us server is going to say, okay, I have these DNS servers that are registered or authoritative for section9.us. Here you go. Our local bind server is going to say, okay, I'm going to go to one of these DNS servers that are authoritative for section9.us. And it's going to go out to that server, one of our cloud servers on DigitalOcean.
Mm-hmm.
And the DigitalOcean server, the bind server we have there, is going to respond to that and give our local DNS server the IP address of section9.us. And then it's going to hand that off to your browser, and your browser is going to be able to display section9.us.
So once that our local DNS server has that information, it will cache it, right? So then if we have another request from another workstation, it's not going to have to go to the root server again, correct?
Correct. And Okay. That's where your TTL comes in. That's the time to live.
Okay.
So every DNS server is going to have a time to live piece to their DNS record. And in our case, we have a default TTL. You can actually change them per record.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at our bind configuration in the cloud, we have, if you look at the file, it has up at the top left-hand corner, the TTL. I don't remember what that's set for. It could be 1 hour.
Yeah.
So that information is going to be cached on our local bind server for 1 hour. Now, there's a lot of things in here that I'm sort of fuzzy about. Your workstation is going to cache this information. How long will it cache it for? I'm not sure. I've never looked into that.
So let me ask you this. And then what happens is, and I know that some of the domains have aliases. And what happens if you change the IP address and this information is cached?
Correct. So this is something that's interesting. And this is something that kind of gets people. When I first started doing things with DNS, the default TTL was typically like 24 hours or 2 days.
Right.
That's kind of what people put in there because the internet was unreliable. Things didn't work all the time. So they figured, okay, if I put in a TTL of 24 hours or 2 days, then even if something goes wrong, people will still be able to access the website or get the email because they'll still have the correct information cached in their own DNS server.
Even if it's the old IP address?
Well, now what you're talking about is, let's say, for example, we move section9.us to a different server with a different IP address.
Right.
Now I need to go update DNS. So what's going to happen here is if I had a default TTL of, let's say, 24 hours, then all of the other DNS servers would have the wrong IP address. So when they would try to go to section9.us, where would they go? The old IP address.
Would it work, though?
No, because I may have taken that server offline.
Hmm.
So if that server is no longer there, it's not going to do anything.
Okay.
I'm not going to get anything back. So people are going to assume the site's down.
So how long do they have to wait?
So it depends on when they cached the information. So let's say it's brand new. They just get this information. And let's say they have it in there for the full 24 hours. Well, they got to wait 24 hours before they get new information. And then the local DNS server is going to say, this information's old, I'm going to purge it. It doesn't go back out and get new information. It just says, this DNS record is old, I'm going to wipe it out of the cache. And then when you go to request section9.us, it goes to the DNS server and it starts the process all over again. Root server, TLD server, authoritative server, and now they have the new information in there. So what's changed over the years is that because things are more reliable, people have decided that it's safer to have a shorter TTL, time to live. So I think what we have configured for Section 9 is 1 hour.
But couldn't you just flush DNS and then, you know, since they wouldn't have the information any longer cached, I guess you would have to know that somebody changed the IP address. Never mind.
Well, but that's a good thing, though. Yeah. Sometimes you do have to flush DNS.
Yeah.
On the local workstation side, sometimes that has to happen. Sometimes you may have to do that on the actual DNS server itself as well, because maybe you have a DNS server that you know there's a lot of stuff in there that's out of date, so you want to flush the cache. But in this case, let's say, for example, we didn't have our own DNS server locally that we managed because we have Bind. If you're getting that information from your ISP, you can't go to your ISP and flush the DNS.
No, you're right.
So every time you make a request, the information that your ISP is going to give you is going to be old information.
Well, not only that, I mean, you don't know how many workstations have request that information. So you would have to, manually flush every single one of them?
So the big issue is going to be the ISP's DNS. You'd have to flush that. Now, you're correct. You would have workstations out there that may have cached that information for Section 9.us. So those workstations, even though we've flushed the DNS information at the ISP level, they would still go to the wrong
address. So they still have to wait for the time to live to expire, correct?
Well, I don't know, because I don't know how the caching works on the workstation side. I mean, when you reboot your machine, the cache goes away and you get new information. But I don't know how long that information lives on the actual workstation. Is it matching the TTL, or is there some other value that maybe Windows or Linux puts on that to say, okay, I have this cached. Do I cache it based on TTL or do I cache it based on something else?
Okay.
That's something I want to look into.
Yeah, no, it's something that we have to look into when we do this again, because I think we should do it again. You know, it was interesting when we had to configure the files and actually put the information that we had to put in there, you know, like the DNS IP address and, you know, what else did we put in there? There was something else, and I'm drawing a blank.
So there's your A records and things like that.
Oh, that's right.
And so that's another thing that we're going to have to take a look at and make sure we understand that, because you brought up at one point, you were talking about the reverse DNS and the pointer records.
And I didn't know about that. See, when I was doing the research on DNS, they were talking about, oh, there's five records. You had the A record that was for the IPv4. You had the quad A record, which was IPv6, right? The C name for the alias. And then they have the PTR, which was the pointer record. And then that's how you had to configure reverse DNS or have that record for it to do reverse DNS. So I found that really interesting, because when I was actually studying for the Net Plus and they were talking about that, I just wasn't clicking for me. It wasn't until we actually did DNS that I understood what it is that we were trying to do. And now I don't really have to study for my Net Plus to know what those are. I know now what they are.
Yeah. And the interesting thing about a lot of the stuff is that if you don't use it enough, you forget. And I haven't been using it DNS is one of those things where...
Well, you set it up, you configure it, and then you're done.
Exactly.
This is why our documentation is so important and why I really liked that we did that with DHCP. Now, DNS is a little bit harder to document. Did you not find that?
So one of the things that we need to talk about here is what we did a couple days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where we get into policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines.
So how... Exactly what I was going to ask you. How does policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines, how did this topics fit into DNS?
So what we did a couple days ago is we looked at the configuration you have on your Debian virtual machine where you do all of your testing. And we've done SSH and DNS and DHCP on that.
Right.
It's great. But one of the things I wanted you to look at, because I was thinking about this as we were doing some of the configuration of different things. And I thought, we should check and see how is the Gigabyte server configured? How is our cloud server configured when it comes to Bind? And so we looked at all the configuration files you have for your virtual machine. We said, okay, here's where they are. Here are the files that I think you need to look at, the important ones that you're going to make changes to. Because oftentimes you'll have a service that has lots of different
options
or configuration files, and some of them you don't even use them. So in this case, we have like three that we look at. So one of the things that we found out when we went to the Gigabyte server, some files were in different locations. You know, your host's file where you put in your SOA and your A records and your C names and all of that, that was over in varlib bind.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go to the cloud server and it's a var cache bind. And then we look at what you have on your virtual machine and it's in Etsy, right? Etsy bind. So now the question is, why is this so spread out? And I think what happened is that we found some documentation that gave examples of how to do things. And so on your virtual machine, that's what we did. We followed the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
When I set up the cloud server, at some point in the past, I had followed certain instructions. And it said, okay, some of your configuration files are going to be in the etc directory under bind. And then we want you to put the file that contains your SOA and all of your A records and all of that. That needs to be over in varcache bind. But then why do we have our Gigabyte server set up to where that stuff is in varlib bind?
Mm-hmm.
It makes no sense.
Right. And I think that one of the things that you and I have discussed is that whenever we're going to do a service like this, it needs to be consistent. It needs to be everything in one place. So we're not all over the place going, where is this at? So I guess that's another thing we have to look into it. Why does it have to be spread out? Does it have to be spread out or can it be in the same place?
Exactly. And that's where we have to talk about policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, and this is a huge part of security, this is what makes or breaks security. If you don't have these things, you don't really have security. Now, we have to talk about how this is going to be applied to your little data center that you're putting together. We're going to have to go through and do all of this for your data center so you can see how this works. And I'd like to be able to do this as well, because I want to see how this applies in a controlled environment. We know what's going on. How do we make these things work for us in terms of these policies and procedures and things of that nature so we can apply appropriate security to this environment?
So do you think that perhaps one of the reason why they're in different places is due to security or?
No. So okay. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about this in a kind of format that works, and we'll see how this goes. So we have to talk about policies first. So the question here is, do we need a policy? And a policy is sort of a statement that kind of applies to the entire organization. You might have an acceptable use policy. You might have a mobile device policy, a remote access policy. And that applies to everybody in the organization. In this case, we don't really need a policy, because we're not trying to say, okay, all DNS servers, you know, it doesn't really fit for that kind of situation. So then we're going to skip that for now, and we're going to look at procedures. Procedures are the way in which you do something. So how are you going to install DNS? That might be a procedure. And so in this particular case, we are going to have that. You have documentation for that. So that doesn't really cover some of the things that we're talking about here. It may be included in that, but then we have things like standards and guidelines. Guideline doesn't really apply here, because a guideline is just a suggestion. We want something more definitive. So I think the two things we want to look at here are procedures and standards.
Yeah.
And the standard is going to be, we're going to say this, where are we going to keep the configuration files for bind? And we're going to make that a standard. So anytime we set up a bind server, here is where we're going to have the configuration files. Some of them may be in Etsy bind. Some of them may be in varcache bind, or wherever it is we decide to put them. So that would be a standard. And then the standard might be included in your procedures, where you say, okay, here's how you set up bind. Here's where the configuration files are going to go. And it's part of your step-by-step process.
Yeah, and it will be in the documentation. Because bottom line, one of the things you used to talk about all the time is when we were setting up the network, if you change something and it wasn't documented, I wasn't going to know about it. and then I was trying to do something else and things were changed. So I think the standard is a good thing because then we're going to know how it works, you know, where things are supposed to be. And that way we're not going to really waste our time running, you know, chasing our tails, trying to find out where is this configuration file for DNS and, you know, so, yeah.
No, and that's something that's the reason why you have these things. And this is more of an IT management issue. You want to make sure that everybody's on the same page so they're not doing what you're talking about, running around trying to figure out where things are instead of actually trying to fix a particular problem or get some work done.
So now that we've gone through the whole thing, you mentioned earlier that you've learned something. So what have you learned that you didn't know or that you forget about DNS?
So one of the things that I'm learning is that you have things out there, instructions on the internet, supposed guidelines or standards that people want to come up with. And so one of the things I'm learning is that just because you see something a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to work for you. And it doesn't necessarily mean that's the only way to do it. As we see here, you have documentation that you followed to say, okay, all of your bind configuration files should be in the etsy bind directory. So all of it is located there. So then why do we have these different configurations where we have some stuff in varcache bind, varlib bind? It makes no sense. So one of the things I want to do is figure out, you know, what is best practice and try to find a location where we keep everything. Is there a problem having everything in the etsy bind directory? Because if there's no issue with that, that's actually where I would like to keep them. Everything is in there.
So is that how you would determine, like for someone like me, that I would be looking at three different ways of doing the same thing? How does someone like me look at it and determine, you know, what exactly it needs to be? Is this the right configuration? You know, because this is one of the things that frustrates me to no end when you say to me, you know, look around, you know, go look at some of the blogs and this, that, and the other. There are things that I have done, you know, when I was trying to learn Linux by myself initially, and I totally, you know, messed up my computer and you had to fix it for me because I followed to the T somebody's instructions and it didn't work out. So, you know, do you think that looking at best practices is how you determine this? Or is there a formula, something, some kind of guideline that you can just sit in there and go, okay, this is how I'm going to determine, you know, that this is okay to go there? I mean, how would you?
So in this particular case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look for some recommendations. And then based on those recommendations, I'm going to make a determination of what might actually work for us. And in this
recommendations,
case,
what kind of recommendations?
So I'm looking for any kind of bind configuration guides.
Okay.
And anything that people recommend in terms of where certain files should be. Because maybe keeping them in the etsy directory is not the right place for these particular files.
There may be a reason for it.
There may be a reason for that. So if they say that, then what we're going to do is we're going to say, okay, what are they recommending here? And if they say varcache bind, varlib bind, whichever one they recommend, whichever one we see people talking about the most, that's probably the one that we should be using. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I'm not entirely sure it matters a whole lot where we put the file. As long as the service works and we're not violating some, you know, best practice, like we're putting it in, you know, some location that we've never seen anybody use, well, that would be goofy. So we're going to try to follow some of what other people are doing, but we're just going to say, okay, if most people are doing this, maybe we should do the same thing.
Right.
And then that's going to become our standard. And sometimes you're in situations where you make a standard and later on you learn that that's not very good, that you shouldn't do that. So then what you do is you say, okay, well, we made a mistake. It is working. It functions just fine, but we're going to change our standard. We're going to let everybody know that it's going to be part of our documentation. And then we're going to change the procedures. And then maybe at some point you move things to different locations. Like let's say, for example, we decide to use varlib bind and we find out later on that that's kind of goofy. More people are putting it in varcache bind. We would just move it over and change our standard.
Well, I mean, for us, it was like, where is this at? You know, so we kind of had to hunt around a little bit. Just, I mean, you know, it wasn't really hard to find, but it took us a bit. So, and you know, for me, one of the things that I really want to do in the podcast is to make sure that people don't waste their time with, you know, information that is not going to be good for them. Like when you go and you get a source that is super crappy, or, you know, that you cannot determine something solid because, you know, the information is not good information. So the solution, after recapping all this, the solution is understand your service, right? And then you need policies, procedures, standards, and guidelines, and not necessary all of them, because you need to understand what's going to work for you, because it's not just set up the same way for everybody. Is that what it was that you were trying to?
Correct.
Okay. And then, so what's next?
So I think that what we're going to have to do next is, since we've talked about DHCP, we've mm-hmm. talked about Bind, we haven't done anything with SSH yet, but that's going to be more of a management thing because there's not a whole lot going on in SSH. I mean, when we do the configuration, it's just like, it's installed, it's running, we make some minor changes, and we're good to go.
Well, I think for DNS and DHCP, we needed to do it again because our initial assessment, you know, we found out as we were trying to work out the quirks that there was a little more to it than that, and we needed to, you know, do it again to make sure that it was solid.
Yeah, and so I think what we're going to do going forward is one of the things I'd like to try to do, since we're recording on the weekend, mm-hmm. I want to try to get a checklist or process going, procedures for installing Raspbian Lite on the Raspberry Pi so that we can start migrating some of these services onto a live system.
And then configure it.
And then configure them and see what happens. And if we have to make changes and modifications, we can do that. But I think we have enough information to begin doing that.
You don't want to do the web server test on my Debian before we do the Raspbian Lite and do all of that?
I think what we should do is try to get some of your services migrated over to a Raspberry Pi and say, okay, we've got these things configured. They function properly. They're working.
Okay.
And that's kind of the heart and soul of your data center. No DNS, no work. No DHCP, well, how are people going to get IP addresses?
Right.
No SSH, how are you going to manage that remote server, mm-hmm. right? You don't want to always plug into it. You want to be able to remotely access that.
No, I get it.
So those are the things that I think are going to be the center of things for a bit. And then little by little, we'll start adding other services on other Raspberry Pis.
No, I understand. And I'm actually excited of starting to implement some of a service on my little Pi Tower. So cool.
Yeah, that's going to be really cool. And then we get to apply things like policies, procedures to that particular setup.
And we do need to, on the documentation, we actually need to add the management piece.
We do.
Because, you know, that I think that's the hardest thing that most people forget to say. You know, they're like, yeah, we want the service or whatever. And then it's like either somebody doesn't manage it, and because they're like, oh, well, you know, we have it until something goes wrong, they don't think about that. Or maybe they do think about it and they're like, oop, I got in over my head. I don't know how to manage it. We need to pay somebody to do it, you know, kind of thing. So I don't know. I think management is important. And I'm looking forward to learning about how to manage the services, to be honest with you.
Yeah. So do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, I don't.
So I do actually have something to say here. I'm working on getting our website moved over to Squarespace, because I'm tired of having to manage WordPress and it's not secure. So one of the issues I have with moving everything over to Squarespace is that our RSS feed for the podcast may change. So I have to make sure I do it correctly so that people who subscribe on iTunes will continue to get updates about our new shows. So that's one thing that I'm working on, and I want to make sure I get that correct. So that's a process that's going to take a bit longer, because not only do I have to think about iTunes, but I want to look at Google for Android and then also Stitcher.
Right.
So those things, those are things that I'm working on, and hopefully I don't mess that up, because when we do make the switch, we will get a different RSS feed, which will change things a bit.
Yeah. Well, gosh, you got your work cut out for you.
Yeah, there is a process to make that happen where, at least for iTunes, it should be seamless. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, no, that's one of the things that I'm, you know, when I first started in IT, I was really afraid to play with the devices, and you would go, just start, just do it, just jump on it. And I look at some of the things that you're taking on and I'm like, God, you're brave, because I would be terrified to screw it all up and just go, oh my God, what am I going to do now? How do I fix this? You know?
But that's the reason why we have a lab. So you play on the lab, you break it in the lab, who cares?
Yeah, no, that's true.
So we have an interesting weekend for us. Hopefully we can get our Raspberry Pis configured.
Yay.
That's it. If you have any comments or questions, you can email us at info@section9.us. And if you want to take a look at our show notes, you can go to section9.us.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening.